So that comes from a very monolithic concept of religion. Throughout the Middle Ages, through most of the Renaissance, you have one monolithic religion, and you have this monolithic idea that God created the earth, the world is unchanging, and it's going to end soon anyway. Okay? By 1600, 1650, 1700, the end of the world is nigh, the world is going to end soon, it's getting a bit stale. That's not quite so believable. And you have the coexistence of Catholics and Protestants and Anglicans, and after the English Republic, of Jewish people in Britain again. Cromwell invites the Jews to return to Britain, partly because he's quite a nice guy in that sense, but mainly because... No. Cromwell wasn't about money. Cromwell was about crazy religion. And the Second Coming was only going to happen after the conversion of the Jews. So it was important to have the Jews in England to convert them to English Protestantism, to Anglicanism, therefore, I mean, not forcefully, voluntarily to convert them, so that you could have the Second Coming. So it's all a bit crazy, but anyway, you have a situation where there are all sorts of truths around people. Yeah, there is now no longer one monolithic truth. As Voltaire said, it's the first modern society, London at this time, it is the first multicultural society. There are quite a lot of black people in London in the 18th century. There are people from, there are lots of Huguenots from Belgium, and well, Belgium didn't exist, from the Low Countries and Holland and all those places, etc., etc. There are people from all sorts of places. There are even some Native Americans in them. So if there is this mixed society where you don't have this idea or the same ideas about everything being set down and established by God, and to some extent God is moving into the background. He's becoming a sort of a side aspect of life rather than a central aspect of life. There are still quite a lot of Puritans around where God is centre stage, but increasingly for a lot of people, religion is a sort of private thing you do on Sundays, etc., etc., but it doesn't affect your day-to-day life in the same way. And so given that change of attitude, for the first time, novelty, originalidad, becomes something which is attractive rather than something which is bad. In the past, novelty, you wrote an original story because you haven't read enough classic stories. Now, for the first time, people are saying an original story is a good thing. So, the Romance had offered a world of wonder without a rational sequence or rational consequences. Yeah? In gods just suddenly appear, and there are earthquakes, and this happens, and there's a monster, and there's a magician in romance. Yeah? So you don't have to have a proper structure, and you don't have process of causes and consequences. A quite important quote that is quite useful for literature classes is, in life things happen, but in novels things happen for a reason. Yeah? And part of the enjoyment of novels is that process whereby you are connecting the dots. Yeah? You are saying that this is the consequence of this, and so you are able to structure the story in a way that the romance doesn't. If you think of something like Lazarus and Thomas, yeah? If you think of something picaresque, they're just episodes. Things happen, but they don't actually affect each other. Yeah? This is the difference with a properly structured novel. the one thing leads on to another and may have a consequence 30 years later. But that cause and consequence process is far more than there is in real life, in fact. Yeah? We live in a pretty arbitrary universe. There are a lot of coincidences. You do meet an old school friend in a pub one evening just because you do, not because there's a meaning to that. You may be offered a job or lose your job, not because there's a reason for it, etc., etc. In novels, generally speaking, as in films, almost everything happens for a reason. And if it does, if something isn't part of that process, you're not shown it. Yeah? You may have a description of a room so that you feel that you're really there and it really happened. But the action is almost always consequential. Okay. That is not the case with romance. With romance, things may happen for symbolic reasons or allegorical reasons, but they don't happen so that you have consequences in the future or that it echoes things in the past, because the structure in that sense is the same thing. So, in the pre-modern world, there is a belief in a divine plan. God has a plan. And that plan can be more or less rigidly applied to everyone in all situations. Yeah? What happens to everyone is determined by God's plan. We don't know what God's plan is, but everything happens for a reason. And the reason, God knows the reason, and that is part of providentia in the sense of Boethia, of Boethius. Yeah? Everything happens because God has planned it, and so you don't need that cause and consequence process because all that's happening in God's head. Again, by weakening religion, especially because of the appearance of deism, do you remember what deism is? Not exactly. No, deism is the more and more. Sorry? They believe in God, yes. Everyone believes in God. Yes, pretty much. God doesn't really intervene in day-to-day life. So, in the 17th century, you will have a situation like in 1623, I think it was, 1622 or 1623, one of those 2 days, there was a Catholic chapel in a first floor flat in London. And the flat collapsed because there were too many people in the room, and lots of people were killed, and lots of people were injured, etc., etc. And the attitude at that time was, look, this is God punishing you for being Catholic. Yeah? In the same way that crazy Americans in places like Pennsylvania will say, if a plane crashes in the Hajj, where people are going to Mecca, or when there's, you know, there's a stampede in Mecca, or one of these types of things, something bad happens, and that's what they say, oh, look, this is for burning Bibles, or because you are Muslims, or whatever. Yeah? They will see God's behavior in everyday events. Now, the much more modern situation of, I think, probably most Christians nowadays, would be to think that God tends to govern the important things, and maybe a guide, and there's a good principle, and all this type of thing. Everyone believes what they want to believe. I'm not telling you what to believe. But there isn't that sort of day-to-day intervention. Yeah? And there are things that just happen. Yeah? A building can collapse just because of gravity and structural problems, not because that's necessarily God doing that each time. And of course that means that God's further away. Yeah? That in deism, of course God exists. It would be stupid for God not to. Everyone knows God exists. But we get on with our lives as well. And it doesn't mean you're going to hate your neighbours because they're Jewish, you're going to hate the neighbours because they're Catholic, or you're going to hate the neighbours across the road because they're Protestant. Yeah? We all get along, and then you do your private thing, which is religion. So there's no longer this divine plan. And moreover, in romance, romance is only really interested in one class, the upper class. Yeah? Only the nobility, the aristocracy and the monarchy are of any interest. The only time they're going to include anybody below that is for comic relief. So yes, you can write picaresque things about how funny poor people are, ha ha ha. Yes, you can have poor people scenes in Shakespeare where poor people act in idiotic ways because they're poor, blah, blah, blah. But the real action, the real interest is in the aristocratic class, because they're the only people that are really human beings, let's be honest. Yeah? That's the attitude. Of course, all of this is changing. After the Civil War, you have and the Glorious Revolution, you have a situation where the bourgeoisie are the dominant class. The traders, the manufacturers, the shop owners, the cities are the places of power, and of course, as well as trade. Yeah? Trade, world trade in the British Empire, and of course, slave trade, which is an important part of it. So, you begin to, there begins to be the potential for interest in people who are not upper class, and who are not just there for comic effect. They can be serious people with serious lives, and they can be people who have a deep inner self. I mean, it's actually quite ironic, because if you take something like, have you heard of Mrs. Dalloway? Have you heard of Mrs. Dalloway?
Yeah. Yeah.
Mrs. Dalloway is a novel by Virginia Woolf, and in fact, you have the complete reversal of this process, because what Virginia Woolf does is she chooses a society lady, so a lady of a good class in London, who doesn't work, who doesn't really have a particularly exciting life, the sort of person who you think is completely frivolous and superficial. And what Virginia Woolf says is, and she describes a day in her life where she has to go out to buy some flowers for a dinner party she's organising that evening. There's not, it's the most inconsequential situation you could imagine, intentionally. And Virginia Woolf is saying, look how complicated, how deep the inner life of even this person is. This person hasn't gone to war, this person is not running the country, this person is not exploring in deepest India or in the Himalayas or anything like that, but this person has a deep inner life. But, so you have, by the early 20th century, a complete reversal of a situation where somebody who is aristocratic, you may think is completely frivolous, I will try and say. If you have the idea that the aristocracy is sort of the Condé Nast or whatever, you know, just the silly people who sometimes appear on television and have a lot of horses, then they have now become the completely superfluous class. But at this time, the superfluous class, or the people who were not of any social interest, any literary interest, was the rest of the population. Yeah? Only the aristocracy were refined and sophisticated enough to be the subject of novel. That changes at this point because of the emergence of this new class. Yes, you can argue, you can say, well, if the number of people who know how to read is a slow process, that's a slow process as well, and you are right. But all of these things come together, work together. So, we suddenly have conducive conditions, conditions which will help the emergence of the novel to go from becoming a sort of very marginal type of literature, which isn't very highly considered, which is the case of all of Daniel Defoe's novels, Captain Singleton, Joan of a Plague Year, Moll Flanders, Robinson Crusoe, I think there's one other, but I can't remember which it is. Anyway, to being what people consider literature. Now, if you talk about literature, if you say I'm doing a course in literature, most people will imagine you're talking fundamentally about novels. Yeah? Yes, there's a bit of poetry around here, there are a few plays there, but literature today, after Jane Austen and Dickens and all those people, George Eliot, blah, 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 the great Victorian writers, they moved the novel from being completely peripheral to being absolutely center stage. And that is the process that we're beginning here. That process where the novel comes to dominate the field of literature rather than being marginal. So, why does it do that? Well, we have a little bit what we said before in reverse. We have the abandonment of this idea of there being a divine plan which affects everybody. Yeah? There's a much more modern concept of religion, doesn't matter if you're talking Catholic, Protestant, Anglican, whatever, that God exists, the world exists, things go on, things happen, but not as part of a divine plan in the sensitive way. There starts to be an interest in character as a reflection, as reflected in the Augustan novel. And this was largely to do with the concept of the individual's role and in the destiny of the world. People begin to become important as people. You're not just important because you are the king or the duke. People, ordinary people, certainly ordinary bourgeois people, ordinary middle class people, can lead interesting lives. As you said, we now have sufficient readers, we have, above all, enough people who have the inclination and the ability to read an extended text about a significant period in somebody's life. Okay? Reading small amounts of text is something that most people can do in the mid-17th century. But the fact of being able to read a novel, and remember, some of the novels we're talking about are over a million words. They are a serious investment of time and money, but especially time. People capable of doing that appear in large numbers in the 18th century. The majority of readers of novels are women. So there is also an element to which the reading of the novel is related, and sorry, the expansion of the novel and the evolution of the novel is related to the exclusion of middle-class women from public life. In the 17th century, a business is normally a family business, which means we live up here, the shop is down there. The shop can be a studio for painting, the shop can be a place that sells food, the shop can be a pub, whatever. But we live up here, that happens down there, and everybody in the family is intimately involved in the business. But the concept of the gloriously useless woman begins to emerge as a bourgeois value in this period. Business expands, there are economies of scale, which means that the shop, the downstairs floor of your house is no longer big enough, you have to go out and build a factory. So there's now no longer a direct relationship between the home and the business, and it becomes a status symbol for the bourgeois man to have a wife who does not work. So you have a lot of women who are reasonably well educated. Girls' schools, certainly girls' schools to the age of about 12, become very common for bourgeois girls at this time, but who aren't allowed to do anything useful. And so they become a major part of that reading public. Now, if you have hours and hours and hours to fill in the day, no Twitter, no Instagram, you have to read books. Terrible. And that begins to take place here. There also begins to be a change of attitude amongst people who are writing. People who have a serious ability to write begin to see extended prose as a worthwhile thing to write. However much you have a lot more people writing, sorry, a lot more people reading, unless you have skilled people who can actually create novels, the novel is not going to increase in value, it's not going to be moved centre stage in literature. You will have people continuing to write slightly lascivious stories about sexual adventures and this type of thing in prose, but you won't start to have the serious novel development. But little by little, important people, not Alexander Pope, but important writers, people who do have an ability to write great literature, are attracted into this field because it's quite lucrative, apart from anything else. Okay. Well, we can also see a lot more, there are more reasons which are more controversial, they're more psychological, they're much more difficult to prove, but I think they're worth mentioning as well. For example, we suddenly have a situation where we have the experience of the London bourgeoisie begins to become important. The specific experience of this specific group of people in one particular city. The greatest city in the world for a short period of time, but it is this period of time. And for the first time you have in human history, really, you have a really, really weird situation. I go out of my door and nobody's wearing a mask. I go out of my door and I walk down my street and I walk into the next street and I go and buy a newspaper or go to a coffee shop or whatever and I come home again and play my little work or whatever. Most of the people I encounter, I have never seen before. They are strangers. That has not really happened in human history before London at this time. When people live in small towns, when Mont Flanders is in Colchester, everybody knows everybody. It's a town of maybe 10,000 people. It's like, I don't know, Sigüenza in the 1980s. Yeah? It's a relatively small space, and everybody knows everybody. And if somebody from outside appears in the town, everyone realizes it's somebody from outside. Are they a tourist? Are they a mass murderer? Are they whatever? Yeah? There is that type of small town mentality. If any of you ever lived in a village, you know what I'm talking about. Most of what we now consider towns are large villages, really, at this time, apart from London, which is this massive space and this massive quantity of people who don't know each other. And one of the important things that's happening in North Flanders is that aspect of anonymity. Yeah? She can put on an accent, put on some fine clothes, and convince people that she's a lady. That can't happen in Colchester because everyone knows who is members of the aristocracy or the gentry class there. In Jane Austen, yeah, everybody who's of a certain level in the surrounding country knows exactly who everyone else is. Yeah, there's no, people don't just suddenly appear unless you can actually, you know, and then they have to demonstrate who they are. But that's not happening anymore. The anonymity is an important element. And what does that mean? Well, that means that, firstly, being able to read character suddenly becomes very important. Yeah? In the old society, I can trust you because you're so-and-so's son, and we've known that family forever, and you're not going to try and trick me in my business because our families know each other, and that would be bad for your family, and blah, 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 blah. But here we're having commercial interactions, day-to-day commercial interactions between people, and you have no idea who they are. And you're maybe lending some money to somebody. Or you're saying, okay, you can pay for that drink the next time you come if you don't have any money. You know, so to actually understand how the other person is working, to see the world through somebody else's eyes becomes very, very important. Yeah? When you are reading a romance, you're not really seeing the world through somebody else's eyes. You're imagining a fictional world that you know is fiction. The point of a novel is that you are going through the experience of living somebody else's life. And okay, you can say it's a fictional life, it's not a real life. That is true. But you know that The person who's written it has made every effort for that to coincide with what is verosimile, what is convincing, what could be the way that people see the world.
But I can memorize what you were talking about before.
Sorry?
About North London.
Yeah, what?
When you were talking about North London realistic,
yeah.
Those kind of realistic.
Exactly, also, yeah. So, there's an extra element to that. I can't remember her name, but there's a modern critic. If I remember, I'll tell you on the internet, on the forum. There is a modern critic, and she talks about stories allowing you to see the world through the eyes of somebody else who has a different set of illusions from the ones you have. Okay? We all have our religious beliefs, our superstitions, our false ideas about the world. Nobody has a completely true idea about the world. Sorry to break that to you, but that's the truth. We all have our little lies that we tell ourselves about the world, whether that is through religious structures or other types of structures. Whether that's I insist I have socks from Marks and Spencer's, which say the day on them, and I have to put on either a sock that says no day or the day correctly, but I cannot wear the socks that say Monday on Tuesday. Just will not happen. My wife knows this, and everybody knows this, and it's just not going to happen. I will put on some other socks. Doesn't matter if it doesn't say the day, but if it says the day, it has to be the right day. One of my illusions about how the world works. It's obviously ridiculous, but I'm happy, and nobody gets hurt. So that's the way I work, as a frivolous example. But that could be, you know, about people's religious beliefs as well. Again, we have the first multicultural society in the world. Being able to see the world through the eyes, not only of another person, but somebody who has a different set of illusions from the ones that you have, is increasingly important. It's of practical importance to the bourgeoisie, because they're trading with these people. They're trading with people from other countries, from other cultures, and from other religions. So that sort of basic level of psychology is very important. What were our names for this period? We talked about this as the Augustan Age, the Age of Satire. Well, the Restoration's a bit, happened a bit of a long time ago by now. The Restoration is 1660. So 60 years later, there is, especially some of the American critics, made the Restoration last a long time. But I think, I would say, certainly once you've moved into the Hanoverian program, period, after 1712, after the death of Queen Anne, to be talking about the Restoration is a little bit, we can say Enlightenment, good. And the other thing which is very much related to that is the Age of Reason. Yeah, the Age of Reason. And so, within the concept of the Age of Reason, a story where things happen for a reason, yeah, where you can see logical sequences built into the story, is attractive. Yeah. Most of these people are business people. They're not sort of with crazy religious ideas or with artistic ideas. They're not hippies. They are business people. They have to think mathematically, practically, etc., etc. And so that process of thinking in a logical, reasonable way, critical thinking, if you like, which is one of the things that literature also helps you to develop, especially this type of literature, because there are causes and consequences, is attractive to them. Yeah? It's like Sudoku, but different. Very different. Anyway. So, it also is very comforting. Suddenly we have a situation where God is slipping into the background, partially disappearing. Yes, he's there, she's there, he's there, she's there, but not doing very much in our day-to-day lives, etc., etc. The novel provides the very, very reassuring idea of a rational universe. If things are done right, the consequences are good. And you get for the vast majority of these novels, there are some which is not the case, like Tristram Shandy, which is much more experimental. But in most of these novels, and not Moll Flanders, by the way, but in most of these novels, you get very, very much the idea that what Oscar Wilde said was the good end well and the bad end badly. Yeah? That you are presented with a world where bad people, malicious people, ultimately are punished and suffer, and good people are ultimately rewarded. It takes quite a lot of time for Tom Jones or Sophie to be recognised in Tom Jones, but they are basically good people, and so in the end they win out. Etc, etc. I won't even talk about the Vicar of Wakefield, which is much, much more of that type of situation, whereas we know perfectly well that very bad people can be very successful, can even become President of the United States, and very good people can have no luck at all. But what we do not live in a rational universe, we do not live in a universe that is governed by morality. Again, if you did not know this, I'm sorry to tell you. Also, from continental Europe, we have from the Enlightenment, we have an increasing emphasis on individualism. And if you're interested in individualism, then the concept of the idiosyncrasies of the individual become increasingly important. If we're all basically the same, then describing the inner workings of a particular person's mind is not really interesting because they're going to have exactly the same mind as you. But if we're not, if we're all individuals, then it can be fascinating to see that that's why he behaves in a way that's different from me, because of this, this, and this. So again, it's that popular interest in psychology coming in and being able to work out what motivates people, how people work. And again, understanding motivation, or today this is marketing departments and all this type of thing, but this is a more primitive society. But if you're running a business, understanding what motivates people, whether it's in the 18th century or today, is hugely important. Yeah? And so there are practical values in novels. There is an increasing emphasis on private lives. One of the reasons for this is that the workplace moves away from the home, as I said. So the home becomes a refuge from the outside world. And little by little you have the idea of the separate spheres. You have the domestic sphere, where the angel of the house, where the woman creates a lovely protective sphere, and everyone feels protected, etc, etc. And then you have public life, which is nasty and terrible and blah, 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 blah. And only men can survive out there. Okay? So, those sexist values that arise out of bourgeois culture at this time, because the home and the workplace are separated physically, they become emotionally separated, and that's what's happening. Because there's an increasing emphasis on private lives, on people having private spaces, private rooms. In Shakespeare's time, most of the time people were sharing beds with strangers. You would go, if you were travelling across the country and you went to a hostel or a hotel, you'd probably sleep with a stranger in the same bed. Yeah? Being a bedfellow doesn't imply sex in Shakespeare. It would be much more interesting in Shakespeare if it did, but it doesn't, unfortunately. It can do as well. It can do on some occasions, but mostly it doesn't. So, that emphasis on that private life means, again, you create an increased interest of what are they doing behind that door? Yeah? What is he or she doing in their private space? You have more time in your private space, you have more time alone, and then so there's more time to read, but there's also more time to be interested in what's happening when you're seeing people. If you live as a family in a single room, privacy doesn't exist. For the aristocracy, of course, privacy doesn't exist. Just think of Downton Abbey. Yeah, you've all seen Downton Abbey? Yeah? You haven't seen Downton Abbey? Excellent. Wonderful. You are pure from not having seen that. But you know the sort of typical aristocratic house. Upstairs, downstairs? Are you very muffled? Have you seen that? Yeah. The aristocracy does not have private lives. There are servants popping up everywhere, yeah? You just do not have a private life. If you have an argument with somebody, you're having an argument in front of a whole load of strangers, etc., etc. It's this class which begins to have private life. Yes, they have servants, but they also have some private space. And the consumption of literature, as I said, begins to become increasingly private. You read a novel alone, increasingly. Literature before tended to be much more public, so people would be reading publicly from the Bible. They would be reading poetry to each other. They would be reading romances to each other. Yeah? And there's still quite a lot of, for example, the father of the family reading a bit of a novel in the Victorian times to everybody else, or another adult. There is still a bit of public consumption of novels, but it is increasingly part of the private experience. And therefore we have a situation where everything is increasingly prosaic. And of course by prosaic I mean in both senses. Because you're interested in realism, writing poetry makes no sense. People do not speak in iambic pentameter. People do not speak in iambic pentameter. Therefore, if your interest is creating a believable context, there's no point in writing in prose. People sometimes rhyme in what they say, but they don't normally rhyme, especially in English. In Spanish, you rhyme much more than you do in English by mistake, just because you have many fewer possible endings. But in English, accidental rhyme is much less common. And so, literature is much more prosaic in that sense, but it's much more prosaic also in the sense of an interest in ordinary lives. Yeah? For all of the reasons that I mentioned. But there are also economic factors in play. And of course, it's the economy that really matters. So, we have a situation where there is now in place, as you suggested, a market, in the sense of people who can read, but there's also a market in the sense of people who have disposable income and can buy books. But perhaps the most important thing in that respect is in fact the lending libraries. And the reason for it, it's curious because when the lending libraries begin to appear, most of the publishers are hugely suspicious and their attitude is these people are going to destroy our sales. But the reality is that you can, because you're having lending libraries traveling all over the country, they're basically traveling libraries. There are quite a lot of them. You sell quite a lot of books if you get your book into the lending libraries. And they're basically providing books to people who didn't buy books in the past or didn't buy very many books. Because books are still a luxury product. Yeah? So it's like buying the sort of, the hardback deluxe version. It's not buying the paperback at this stage. So you're still, you have to really, 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 really want to buy the book. For some reason, for you to actually buy it first hand, blah blah blah, at this time. But to be part of a lending library and to be borrowing the book and paying for books in that way is accessible to the vast majority of the middle class population. So that is important, as well as a rise in their disposable income. And of course, what we have increasingly is a situation which allows for the proper marketing of these things. So, in the past, you might buy a book, you read your book, you now have a book, and you put the book on the shelf, and what do I do now? But in a society where there are a lot of periodicals circulating, a lot of people are reading, you have a process whereby the sort of thing that, I mean, there's some of it's just advertising, but also because you have a lot of book reviews, you are able to have a much better chance of finding out what you want to read, and each time it being a satisfying experience, rather than a sort of hit and miss, I like the title, I like the colour of the cover, type buying books, because people are reading about books. And of course, again, it becomes important to be minimally literate in the sense of you have to have at least read the canon, you have to at least read what are considered the most important works of the culture. But also, it's probably a good idea to have a bit of a knowledge of what's popular at the moment. Yeah, in the same way as, you know, socially, for example, my wife and I don't tend to talk about films and things. We watch a lot of films. We watch a film every day. But because we have all sorts of things saved on Mobby Star, we're watching what we saved 6 months ago. But if you want to be interesting in society, we're not very interesting in society, but if you want to be out there and interesting and have interesting things to say in the office or when you're with friends or whatever, you want to be able to see the latest film, yeah? And be able to comment on that. We can never comment on the latest film. We saw Parasite recently, 2 or 3 weeks ago, rather than 6 months ago. So there is that pressure, there is that social pressure in terms of being able to interact with people, of course. Getting on with people, sharing something like common knowledge of a book or a film, or in today's society, a football team or whatever, means it's much more likely we're going to be able to do business. Yeah? Because finding that common ground is important. So there's a practical side to it. Again. I wonder what pictures I have. Any interesting pictures? Ah, right. So this is the Tales of Genji. This is something else. This is something else. This is the Roman thing. This is people being carried off to the moon. That's something else. Anyway, it doesn't really matter. So there we have a bit of a picture. Most of that I've mentioned. Yes. So the novel appears, and the novel appears as a hybrid genre. What are the elements that go into the invention of the modern novel? What other types of writing help to converge to create the modern novel? Short stories, essays, good. So we have short stories, things like Afrobend's Orinoco. Orinoco is not really long enough to call a novel, and it's very much about an adventure. There is some cause and consequence, it is a period in somebody's life, etc., etc., but it's a little thing, not a big thing. You might possibly be able to call it a novella in English. The word novella implying a short novel, but it's not really long enough to call it a novel. Essays, periodical essays, good. Why? What aspect of them? Exactly, the character sketches. That one of the great interests in the periodical essays is just this depiction of a character. Portraying somebody in writing, not just their physical appearance, but giving the impression of somebody who you can meet, somebody who you can know. And most of the periodical essays have a central character with some friends and family around who will appear as well. And they are the people who are commenting on whatever. I mean, they can be literally somebody like Mr. Spectator in The Spectator, or Sir Isaac Bitterstaff, I think it is, in The Tatler, etc., etc. you have this character, and once they get worn out, you change character, you change the name of the periodical, and you start and you do something else. But that idea of describing character, and just this idea, ooh, I can recognize, so that reminds me of my friend Ben, and, you know, being able to sort of see somebody in that, not to the extent that you're thinking that is a satire of this person I know. There are too many people in society. But you begin to get an idea of types and idiosyncrasies and all of that from these descriptions. What else?
Biography.
Biography, good. We start to have collections of the lives of important people. Now, we've had that since Pliny. But we have ideas of important, the lives of virtuous British people, and increasingly we have the lives of, it written not as a collection, but as a single description of the life of people who are important. We have a collection of the lives of literary figures. But of course, at the same time, we have the lives of rogues. We have the lives, the descriptions of criminals who are going to be executed. That can be in the form of the Newgate Calendar, or it can be, there can be independent pamphlets, or even short prose descriptions. And again, these things are glorified. They are they're not completely realistic in a real sense. They are adorned, if you like, but they have to appear realistic so they can be believable. So there you tend to have, yes, originally generals and kings and queens and upper class people, increasingly other people in society who are deemed to be important, but at the same time people from lower down in society, and so you begin to move towards that whole importance of biography, and that of course matures completely with Boswell's Life of Johnson, which is the first great biography. We also have collections of letters. Okay? Because these people are literate, they have a bit more free time, there's a lot of letter writing going on. They letter write like you text. And as I think I mentioned last time, there is in London a very highly developed postal system. So your letters get delivered very, very quickly, and it is a very sophisticated form of communication within London. Once you go outside London, it's more of a problem. But within London, it is a highly developed system. And of course, that feeds directly into the epistolary novels. There are pamphlets, which is to some extent related to the Newgate Calendar, which basically are collections of pamphlets. All of that sort of thing. And there are also conduct books. Okay? People increasingly want to know how to behave and increasingly want to buy books for their daughters to tell their daughters how to behave. And so you can do that by a long list with bullet points and that sort of thing, or you can do that through a story. And as advertisers and everybody else knows increasingly in today's society, by turning something into a story, that is how people learn naturally, through story. It's a much better idea, rather than telling people rules, telling them a story where they learn those rules. Of course, that's been happening for a long time. It's been happening since Beowulf, since the Fairy Queen, etc., etc. We've had fictional writing, we've had conduct books dressed up as fictional writing. But that also feeds in here. And because there is no established market for novels, the market is being created, all the early novelists are published in other genres too. A lot of them are poets, some of them are playwrights, all of them are periodical essayists, all of them. And that is why we have a hybrid genre, because people are coming from different places, if you like, into this area and emphasizing different aspects of the novel and learning from each other in that way. What made the novel distinctive from poetry and drama was its freedom from traditional generic constraints. Poetry and drama had things like Aristotle's Poetics, La Poetica, or Horace's writing about decorum, or all these types of things. You have a lot of classical writers telling you what to do. And you have people like Alexander Pope and all of those types of people saying, oh, it's very important to respect the classical ideas and this type of thing. They are, after all, in neoclassical times. That doesn't happen with the novel. Yes, there has been prose writing since 1200 BC in Egypt and with the Romans and all of these, but nobody has codified it. It's been off the radar. Yeah? It's been too popular, too unimportant for anybody to say this is what you should do, this is what you shouldn't do. So you can experiment. There's far more freedom in the novel than there is in any of the other forms. Yeah? You want to write a play, and it really should be a five-act play, and then there are unities, and there's this, and there's that, and the other, and there are all these rules, and if you don't follow the rules, you may write a very good play, but people can say, ooh, we haven't followed the rules. Ooh, we wouldn't watch that, we haven't followed the rules. Yeah? That's not going to happen with a novel, because there are no rules to follow. And so, before 1700, stories are dominated by aristocrats and kings. After that date, the monarchy basically disappears largely from novels, and if you're trying to write something realistic, you can't really write about the monarchy because you don't really know. You don't know about the monarchy's private lives, and you're probably better off not writing about it because you get in trouble anyway. They're too distant. Yeah? If you want to write about King Arthur, if you want to write romance, that's fine because you're writing about somebody who, you know, a long time ago probably didn't exist, etc. If you're interested in realism, you just don't know about their lives. Yes, now we know enough about these people's lives to write films about Diana, this nonsense. But we don't, at this time, you didn't know enough about their lives. To do that. And increasingly, the main focus is the bourgeoisie as the main character. Now, that does not mean that the aristocracy vanish in the way that poor people vanish. Poor people still do not exist in the same way as you wouldn't talk about your washing machine, as we said before. But the goal of most of the bourgeois people is to marry into aristocratic families. And not the idealized goal, but the practical goal of a lot of aristocratic families is to marry the bourgeoisie to get the money. Because your aristocratic lifestyle, gambling, hunting, not doing anything useful, is very expensive. And so there is a lot of cross-fertilization between these two groups at this time. You cannot say, I mean, there are some Marxist literary critics who sort of seen this as class war between the bourgeoisie and the aristocracy. That is not a fair representation of what happens in the novels or what's happening in society. The two classes are competing, but they're also interacting and working together and intermarrying. So it's not exactly, I mean, that is, for me, is not class war. That is a situation where a lot of people are confused, they still have old values, and to have a title in your name, to be Sir such and such, or to be a baronet or a camp or an earl, or, to marry Darcy is still very, very, very attractive, to marry into the aristocracy. But you have your bourgeois values. And so the aristocracy tends to exist as the long-term goal of maybe marrying one of them, at the end of the story. But the focus of the story is on the bourgeois family. Yeah? I mean, an absolutely obvious example of that is everything that was ever written by Jane Austen. Yeah? A bourgeois family, and then, you know, if you play your cards right, you marry Darcy or whoever it is. Moll Flanders is sub-bourgeois. The interest in Moll Flanders is because of this. There is this fascination with this crazy, dangerous working class, or lumpen, if you like, criminal class for the bourgeoisie, because they are threatening, they're frightening, and therefore they're excited. They're exciting. And the clever ones can pretend to be bourgeois, like Moll Flanders. So there's an interest in knowing about them. But Moll Flanders never gets into that bourgeois category, really. Even when she's old, she is somebody who has enough money not to work, but she's not really bourgeois in the sense of that's the sort of sense that these people would understand. Now, the exception to what I have been saying about the classes, to some extent, is the patrician hero. And I will try and, I don't know if I'll have time. I would have been that. I'll post the notes, and the notes talk about the patrician hero. Sir Charles Grandison, which is a novel by Fielding, is the most important example of this, and hugely influential on later writing by people like Byron and Jane Austen, etc. You have, as a type of conduct book for gentlemen, you have this idealized gentleman who is a little bit aristocratic and has a lot of largesse, looks after poor people, looks after anybody who's a little bit idiotic, has women going mad over him, beautiful, you know, handsome, perfect man. And of course, this is absolutely ripe for satire. And that's a lot of what people like Jane Austen are doing. This book, Sir Charles Grandison, was Jane Austen's mother's favourite novel. And so Jane Austen spends a lot of her time in her novels just making absolutely ridiculous this idea of the sort of perfect aristocratic or perfect gentleman, blah, blah, blah. There can be aristocratic families, aristocratic characters. It doesn't mean that they completely disappear. But it tends to be how they interact with the bourgeoisie that becomes important. Right. Part two in the remaining 12 minutes. And then we will get to part three. Okay, so we have different types of novel emerging. We have, to some extent, a picaresque novel coming, which obviously has a very strong parallel in Spain. This type of thing starts more or less at Shakespeare's time. You have things like Thomas Nash's The Unfortunate Traveller. Nash was a contemporary of Shakespeare's. But that feeds in very much to something like Moll Flanders. There's lots of picaresque in Moll Flanders. And also in something like Jonathan Wilde by Fielding. Who is Jonathan Wilde? Jonathan Wilde. Oh dear. Jonathan Wilde, which is the name of the novel by Henry Fielding, historically Jonathan Wilde was the thief catcher on which The Beggar's Opera was based, which you should know for your exam, which you have to do in January, so you have to advise that. Okay, we have, increasingly we have Bildungsroman. What is Bildungsroman? What is Bildungsroman? You look very worried.
It's when the character, like a cat, or a series of situations that a character has to look through, not to grow, or?
Yes, it is the description of how somebody goes from being a child to being an adult. Yeah? So Bildung is related to building in the sense of creation. format was novel, it was a novel of the creation of an individual adult. It is, in popular parlance, you would talk about a coming-of-age novel with hyphens. If you're in a literary context, using the German expression Bildungsroman sounds good. If you write coming-of-age novel, that's perfectly correct. But we do like to say Bildungsroman, if we can. Okay, so we have increasingly that. We have cases of that like Tom Jones, and other novels like, well, we get in the next year we will see Jane Eyre is another example, blah, 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 blah. We have different types of epistolary novels. We have monologic epistolary novels. What does that mean? What is a monologic epistolary novel? Monologic epistolary novel. What is a monologic epistolary novel, people on the internet?
When the author is telling you
of the letter that he's writing? No, not the author. It is a novel, so there are characters and things. It's not just somebody speaking directly. No, you have only one person's letters. It's like if you are looking at the text messages of one smartphone and not the other one. Yeah. So you have just what one person says. Yeah. And then novels are taken together. In one sense, it's much more realistic.
Just
Pamela writing and not the other side writing back. So you have to infer what the other person has answered. Now, in the case of Pamela, you actually get a few letters from the other side coming back, which have been intercepted somehow, we don't know how. But most of the letters are from one side. Of course, a dialogic epistolary novel is much more satisfying because you get dialogue, you get people interacting. But it's much less realistic, because how do you collect the letters that have gone both ways? Unless somebody at the end comes along, collects all the letters, and then collates them, then it's not very realistic. But it is much more satisfying. And of course, you can have a polylogic epistolary novel. It's 8 minutes past. It's too early. Can't do that. Yes, Frankenstein is a polylogic epistolary novel because we have letters from, ruined by the bell, not saved by the bell. Go and vote, Douglas, go and vote. An example of Frankenstein being a polylogic epistolary novel. In terms of a dialogical one, we have Clarissa. Clarissa is a complete nightmare. Clarissa is over a million words long. It's enormous. The only people who ever read Clarissa these days are people who are studying an English degree, and they have to. There are huge limitations to epistolary novels, of course. And what tends to happen in the end is that people have some sort of epistolary structure, and then they fill in bits between them. So there are letters being exchanged, because that's a normal part of life. It's like writing a novel about today without people using smartphones. Yeah, if you're writing about today, smartphones and messages are going to appear. Yeah? But to write a novel only with text messages, I think some people have done this experimentally. It must be incredibly awful to read. I really could not imagine wanting to read something like that. And this is a little bit the same. So you have, for example, the novel First Impressions, written by Jane Austen, as an epistolary novel formally, but she then converts that into Pride and Prejudice, where there are 43 letters, yes, but there's an awful lot of action, which is not in letters. And that, of course, is much, much, much more than the fabulous one. Are we reading anything by Lord Byron this semester? No. Are we reading anything by Lord Byron next semester? Yes. We are going to read book one, most of book one of Don Juan, which you have to pronounce Don Juan. You cannot pronounce it Don Juan, because if you pronounce it Don Juan, then the rhyme doesn't work. So, yes, but not this year, next year. Late February, probably, maybe March, maybe the first lesson in March. Okay, I'm sorry we did not have time to finish. I will post the tutorial notes on the forum, of course. I did not post them this time on purpose, because I wanted you to finish all flowers successfully in some cases, less successful in others. But please try and have as much of all flowers as possible read for next week, because the more you have read, the more we will be able to interact and the more you will get out of the class. Bye-bye! Please use the forum to ask questions. That is what it is there for. I would like to have more interaction on the forum, not just me posting things. I want to know what interests you, what you find difficult, what you want extra explanations for, etc. Good, thank you. Okay, I'm going to turn it off now. Bye-bye.